human beings have never existed in an environment where microbes did not exist. In fact, no multicellular organism has existed in an environment in which microbes haven't existed. So our interpretation of an environment, our metabolic strategies, our immunological strategies, all these strategies are born out of us interpreting environmental signals through a film of bacteria that's within and on us.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series on metabolic health through the gut. In this series, we speak with experts about how gastrointestinal physiology, including gut microbes, can affect cardiometabolic health and body weight.
I welcome everybody to the latest edition of the ISAP series of podcasts on science, microbes, and health. Today, as usual, I'm joined by my colleague, Gabrielle Vinderola. And today, we're particularly delighted to welcome Dr. Amir Zarinpar, who's an associate professor in the Division of Gastroenterology at UC San Diego. Dr. Zarinpar is a renowned expert in the field of microbiome research and its application to human health and disease. His work focuses on understanding the complex relationships between the gut microbiome, circadian rhythms, and host metabolism, with the goal of developing novel therapeutic strategies for diseases such as obesity, diabetes, and liver disease. Dr. Zarinpar has published numerous papers in top-tier journals, which we'll discuss, and has received several awards for his research, including the Litwin IBD Pioneer Award and the American Gastroenterological Association's Microbiome Junior Investigator Research Award. He's also a dedicated mentor and educator, having supervised numerous students, fellows, and junior faculty in his laboratory. So welcome, Dr. Zarinpar. It's great to have you here today. So I guess my first question to you is a fairly simple one. How did you get into the microbiome field?
Well, Eamon, thank you for inviting me to this podcast. I'm very excited to be here and to talk about microbiome therapeutics and the microbiome in general. I actually started doing research in the gut microbiome in a way somewhat randomly. I worked in a circadian biology lab, and I was one of four co-first authors that worked on a concept that lab was investigating called time-restricted feeding, where we were looking at how restricting or confining feeding to the normal time for mice, how important of a role that played in maintaining the mouse's health and preventing diabetes and obesity and liver disease and so on and so forth. Because I'm a physician scientist trainee, I had to take time off after we published that study to go back and do my clinical training. And when I returned to the lab, my colleagues in the lab had already started investigating other aspects of that study and moving it forward in different directions. And so I was kind of worried about what I would do next. At that time, my postdoctoral mentor, Sachin Panda, suggested that, you know, you're a gastroenterologist, why don't you investigate the gut microbiome? You know, I think that's going to be really important in the future. And I remembered thinking, oh, the microbiome is a fad. No one can really do mechanistic research in the gut microbiome. And a lot of the work that's being done in that space is correlative. But as I did more and more digging and more research into the available literature at that time, I became intrigued by how dynamic the microbiome was. In particular, there were a couple of papers that came out soon after I had that conversation with Sachin that showed, first of all, that the microbiome was very dynamic, that it was very responsive to dietary changes. And second, it was essential for normal host circadian rhythms. And then the rest was history. You know, we decided to investigate this relationship further and further, and we're in the thick of it now, still trying to understand what the relationship between the two are and how each is important to the other and the role they distinctly play in affecting host metabolic health. So
before we get into metabolic health, I did notice one paper of yours which spoke about the timing of sampling in relation to the circadian rhythm. How important is that in terms of the timing of sampling of the microbiome in humans?
In humans, I think that the jury's still out. We are working on a paper right now where we're investigating that further. We presented an abstract based on some of the preliminary findings, which shows that the human microbiome is also dynamic with cyclical fluctuations. But one big difference between human and mice is that humans in general, on average, you produce a fecal sample once per day, whereas mice are constantly doing it throughout day and night. So I think that when we're just discussing the fecal microbiome, it's going to be hard to characterize in humans. And when you look at a population level, like we did in this abstract and what we're working on right now, we do see cyclical changes. But the significance of that cyclical change is going to be interesting. Right. We can go off topic a little bit and talk about seasonal changes and things of that sort. But the important thing to know is that the microbiome is dynamic. It is responsive to what people are eating and the time of day and whether you're fasting for a long period of time. It can affect the composition of the microbiome. And one of the questions that we've you asked this question about timing of sample collection, how important it is. You know, one of the questions that I always ask myself is that when we say that there is a 20% difference between an experimental group and a control group in terms of their microbiome composition, what does that really mean when within this control condition, there's an 80% change depending on day or night? And so what makes that 20% so much more important than the 80% that changes within normal cycling? And I think that that's always been a question for us as to if we're really attributing a lot of physiological or pathophysiological conditions to compositional changes in the microbiome, when, especially in a mouse, when more than 80% of the microbiome is different from in day and tonight, how do we balance that? How do we understand these changes in context of what's normal?
Another confounder.
Exactly.
Gabriel, I'm going to let you jump in here.
Yes, Amy, thanks for being with us today. And I will dig a little bit in your mouse model. You combine circadian rhythms. You also add time restriction feeding, but also the diet, the quality of diet. You use also high fat diet. And what do you see when you combine these three variables? What are the outcomes that you see?
Sure. So let's talk about a normal mouse, normal wild type mouse. When I say normal, I mean a B6, which is the one that we all use, or many of us use, I should say, that's on a normal diet, normal chow diet. When you have a mouse on a normal diet, it tends to eat about 80% of its food in the nocturnal period. And it tends to eat this in two large meals, one right when the light turns off, and another one right before the lights turn on again. And if you had a wheel in that cage, they're running a lot more in that wheel during the nocturnal period, whereas in the time when the light's on, they're spending most of their time sleeping. And what we saw in the microbiome of those mice is that there are these very large fluctuations in the composition of the microbiome, that there tends to be this nighttime microbiome that we think is related to feeding. And that once the mouse starts eating, you see these very large shifts that, again, change once the mouse is in the light period and sleeping, to the point where the composition of the microbiome right before the mouse eats is a third state. It's radically different from both the feeding and the early fasting period. So there are these large fluctuations that happen in a normal mouse. In a mouse that is given a high fat diet, and in this case, I literally mean a high fat diet where 60% of the calories are from lard, basically animal fat, these mice change their feeding pattern and change their behavior. So they increase their daytime eating to about, they double or even triple it. So instead of about 15%, it can go up to 30 or 40% of the calories are consumed in this light period. And they tend to have a little bit less activity, which expands as time goes by. Their activity decreases as they become more and more obese. And their sleeping pattern becomes perturbed as well. And so there are all these behavioral changes that occur within a week of being on this deleterious diet.
How is that mediated?
How is that mediated? That's a million-dollar question. We don't really know. You know, we always, you know, clearly there are some circadian consequences of having this bad diet. And when I first observed it as a postdoc, you know, this was actually reported by Joe Bass's group in Northwestern. We replicated in our lab. And my thinking was that, you know, this is lard. And I don't know about you, but if you take a little too much of a stick of butter, you kind of feel kind of queasy and it's hard to eat. And I'm just wondered whether the fact that these mice are eating such a high fat food, they just have to pace themselves in terms of meeting their caloric needs, that it becomes, you know, in terms of volume of food eaten, they don't have very large meals. So that may be related to it, but I think at this point it's conjecture. I don't really know. I don't think anyone really understands why this feeding pattern changes.
Well, can you trace the sequence of events? Namely, you change the diet to a high-fat diet, the microbiome changes, their physiological changes, and their behavior changes. Can you piece those together in terms of a timeline?
So that's a really good question. I don't know the exact time resolution. What we do know is that these changes are fairly rapid. So within a week, we do see the feeding pattern change. In terms of activity and sleep, it occurs at around the same time. But of course, in terms of finding significant changes in obesity or in terms of the adiposity of the mouse, or significant changes in the blood sugar, it takes about 6 weeks or a little bit longer to see all those things. So those are more downstream consequences. Those aren't immediate consequences of these changes in behavior. But in terms of whether the sleeping pattern occurs first or the feeding pattern, they occur relatively at around the same time. To be honest, I'm not aware of a study that has specifically looked at the time resolution of this other than, you know, what happens a week later. So it hasn't been done. I could be wrong, and there may be something that's already published, but nothing that I'm aware of that's looked at, like, you know, how many hours after putting a mouse in a high fat diet do we see the change in sleeping pattern or the change in activity or the change in food consumption?
Most study with the microbiome are done with 16S sequences, metagenomics, but you use metatranscriptomics. Can you explain for the audience that they are not expert what is metatranscriptomics? Why do you use that? What information that is different from metagenomics you can get?
Absolutely, yeah. So that's a new study that we published recently. Basically, that study was driven by the fact that when you put a mouse in time-restricted feeding diet, they are protected from all the consequences of this deleterious high-fat diet. And we thought that the reason for that is because of this restoration of the cyclical fluctuations in the microbiome. But when we did the 16S study, as you mentioned, Gabriel, that what we saw was that, yes, there were some changes. Yes, there was some restoration of cycling, but it was very modest, very modest. And we had expected these big cyclical fluctuations that we'd seen in the normal mice to occur in time-restricted feeding. And it was far more closer to what we saw in IFAT diet and the diet-induced obesity mice than it was to the normal chow mice. Nevertheless, when we looked at the metabolome of these mice, we saw very large shifts that were, you wouldn't really predict from these compositional approaches to the microbiome. And so that made us conclude that it may be that the microbes aren't changing as much, but what the microbes are doing is what's changing. And Gabriel, you mentioned metagenomics. So metagenomics is looking at the DNA that is in the stool, and then by mapping them into, comparing them to, say, known genomes, reference genomes, we can try to figure out what genes are available in the microbiome of the mice that we're looking at. But that just tells you which genes are available. It doesn't actually tell you which genes the bacteria are using. So in order to better understand what the bacteria are actually doing, we decided to take out the RNA instead of the DNA. So take out the transcripts, which is much more computationally expensive, as well as you need to get far more deeper sequencing to better understand what transcripts are present. And we also had to do it with the metagenomics so that we can try to annotate what these transcripts are, or by annotate, I mean, try to tell what these transcripts are, what their purpose is, as best as we could moving forward. So once we looked at, once we have these annotated transcripts, then we have a better idea what the microbiome is actually doing at these different time points. And through that analysis, we were able to see that particular transcripts that changed in line with some of our metabolomics results were much more predictive as to what was happening with time-restricted feeding. And then, of course, the best part of that paper was that when we took these transcripts and we used engineered bacteria to knock these functions into the microbiome, we were able to replicate some of the metabolic beneficial effects of time-restricted feeding with these overexpressed transcripts into the microbiome. So that way we were able to go a little bit past the correlational, but actually showing that these transcripts potentially can be imparting the benefits of time-restricted feeding.
What are the implications of that particular study for diet, weight loss, weight gain, obesity, and obesity-related complications in humans?
I think one of the things that has frustrated me as a microbiome researcher is that because we can do a really good job, we've been able to do a good job of characterizing microbial communities with 16S and metagenomics for over a decade now, that because that's something we're able to do and do well, it makes us think that it is important. However, I think that what a lot of the other data, like the metabolomics and the host response to in the metaproteomics that's going on as well, is more suggestive that the functions of the microbiome, what the community as the whole is potentially able to do, or particular members of the community able to do, and even with some of our prebiotic studies showing how important certain substrates are for the bacteria to produce beneficial compounds from them, is all suggesting that what the microbiome is doing is more important. Now, it's something I like to tell some of my students is that, you know, the diet in, say, Saudi Arabia and Japan are very different, but there are, and the microbiome of individuals in those countries are very different. But individuals in those countries develop diabetes and obesity in the same way and with completely different microbiomes and completely different diet. So if the microbiome is playing an important role, it must be something that it's doing that is causing that physiological response. And the way that I extend that further is that oftentimes we use this language as to the microbiome is doing something, which then calls into question, you know, who's the puppet and who's the puppet master. But really what I like to, the way that I have to force myself to rethink this is that the host is trying to understand what is happening in the environment through what it's getting from the microbial substrates or the microbial signal. That human beings have never existed in an environment where microbes did not exist. In fact, no multicellular organism has existed in an environment in which microbes haven't existed. So our interpretation of the environment, our metabolic strategies, our immunological strategies, all these strategies are born out of us interpreting environmental signals through a film of bacteria that's within and on us. So what I'm hoping that we can do with this paper is kind of start this conversation or this collective investigation on what is it that microbes are doing and why are we interpreting these signals in these very specific ways and altering our metabolic strategies in response to them. What is, you know, in that paper, we changed bile acids with these genes that we knocked in. So what is so important about bile acids that the host is thinking, wow, now that I'm getting a lot more of this bile acid, maybe I should decrease the amount of glucose that I make with my liver or store more glycogen as opposed to fat. Like, why is it making these kind of metabolic strategic changes in response to these
signals? that's not related to the role of bile acids as signaling molecules in relation to satiety and other eating behaviors?
So basically, they're making these different metabolic strategies in the setting of consuming the same amount of food. So we had this other paper where we showed how we can knock in these bile acids with, these bile acid modifying genes using engineered bacteria. And in that one, what we're seeing is that the mice are eating the same amount of food. They weigh the same. But what's different is their baseline glucose or postprandial glucose is different. Their postprandial insulin is different. And our subsequent studies now show that this is mediated through suppression of gluconeogenesis, that this, you know, if you wait long enough, it does affect their lean body mass and fat mass, that all this is really suggesting that it is, that the mouse is altering its metabolic strategy in a way that can't be explained by just satiety and food intake. It's by these bacteria SIPs.
Is that a direct signaling function of bile acids within the luminal environment?
We believe so, because the only difference between the mice and the control and experimental condition in these studies is one gene expressed in one bacterial species that makes up less than 0.1% of the microbiome. So we do believe that that has a lot of metabolomic effects. So the bile acids are changing. The microbiome itself is, the composition of the microbiome didn't change in that initial study when we assessed it with 16S. But because of the metabolomics change, we presume that the host strategy has changed as a result.
You use the phrase metabolic strategy a lot in discussing your work. Is that when you talk about metabolic strategy for the mouse or even for humans?
What I mean by metabolic strategy, I think that's a good question as to what do I mean by, well, what I mean by that is that, you know, certainly when you calorically restrict the mouse, that mouse loses weight. Or if you change the quality of the diet, so if you give them the same amount of calories, but now with high fat diet or more deleterious composition, then that mouse becomes metabolically unhealthy. But when you have the same diet, same amount of food, then I do think that the host, but then you have different metabolic phenotype, then that suggests to me that there is something that the host is doing. And that's where I come up with metabolic strategy, that for some reason, the host is deciding to utilize his caloric intake or his nutritional intake in a way that is different from normal or controlled.
And Amir, do you think that this time restriction feeding could have impact in other diseases, neurocognitive deterioration, for example? Are you thinking in using those models?
That's a really good question. Time restricted feeding has been investigated in mice in multiple disease models, particularly metabolic disorders as well as cancer. In humans, what we see, so one of the things that makes humans different from mice is that when we calorically restrict, we drop our resting metabolic rate, and mice don't do that. And so the weight loss effects of time-restricted feeding in humans is very modest, but its metabolic effects are quite pronounced. So the effects it has on, for example, blood pressure, cholesterol measurement, even insulin sensitivity are more than you'd expect with the weight loss that these patients attain. I do think that there is more interesting things going on in terms of, for example, the importance of microbiome and gut permeability being something that probably fluctuates with time of day, depending on whether the animal is fasting or eating. And so I wouldn't be surprised if time-restricted feeding has effects on more immunologically related disorders.
Anyone that is listening to this podcast may have the temptation to say, okay, if I don't have a healthy diet, maybe I will do time restriction. Is there a message or no?
So, of course, making any kind of dietary changes, you should check with your physician. I don't want to make a blanket statement that sort of use. But I would say this, that for people who are consuming food throughout day and night, that they have, like, you know, if they're eating something right before bed or have this lifestyle in which circadian rhythms are not well regulated, the impact of time-restricted feeding is likely to be much more pronounced in an individual who has regular sleep hours and doesn't have these, like already doesn't eat right before bed or things like that. I think that, you know, each individual's mileage will vary, but I do think that some of the clinical trial evidence that's out there suggests that there are a lot of secondary benefits to time-restricted feeding that has been very hard for us to, I mean, there are things that we can measure like cholesterol and insulin and things of that sort, but patients who have adopted it do talk about improved sleep habits or improved like sleep quality and improved exercise tolerance and things of that sort. Some things that are a little bit harder to characterize. I think for us as scientists, we need to understand the relationship between these things better so that we can explain them. But I think time-restricted feeding is a relatively easy habit to adopt. And if people would like to try it out to see if it benefits them, then they should. You know, it's not expensive.
Exactly. You can do it on your own at home.
And, you know, I think that there may be some social consequences, depending on which times that you decide to restrict. I think that, you know, clearly I hear a lot from people who say that it's great. And, you know, so I get a selection bias in terms of people who are telling me it's good. But I think that it might be interesting to try for some individuals.
Amy, we're coming to the end of the very, very nice podcast. If people want to hear more about your work, are you in social media, LinkedIn, any webpage that you would want to comment?
So our lab webpage is zarinparlab.org. So just my last name, lab.org. And I am on LinkedIn and on what is formerly called Twitter. I'm not as active on Twitter as I was before, but on LinkedIn, I am a bit more active and we do post our new papers there. So, and we would love to engage with people who find our science interesting. The bulk of this work has been in metabolism, but we are slowly expanding to colorectal cancer and aging and inflammatory bowel disease, because we think that this cyclical characteristic of the microbiome is such an important part of normal homeostasis. And we see it having an effect on so many different physiological and pathophysiological conditions.
Amy, it was a great conversation, at least for me. I hope for the audience. I have to thank you once again for accepting this invitation. Well, thank you so, so much.
Thank you for having me and thank you for these wonderful questions. I really enjoyed this very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions, or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. And check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.